Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to another episode of Voices for Excellence. I am your host, Dr. Michael Connor, CEO and founder of the Agile Evolutionary Group, and also the proud host of VFE. And today's guest, I am absolutely biased and subjective when I say this. I love this man to death. I love him. He is by far, I would say he's brilliant, right? Brilliant with the vigor and the rigor that he's bringing into the education ecosystem. I love the tactics of the knowledge, core knowledge, but be able to bring that level of objectivity in the context of disrupting historical systems, structures that have been concretized within our education ecosphere, specifically on the status quo. And he challenges the status quo with depth and breadth. Kunal Dalal is absolutely, I like to say, I look up to him. And you know, the stuff that he presents, the innovations around AI that he underscores has to be heard. And we've been talking for a while now, and to absolutely have him on VFE, this is kind of my excuse to give to you, the audience, a brain dump of one of the smartest individuals, specifically in that vertical of AI that I know. So without further ado, Kunal, good brother, how are you, man? Welcome to the show and to my audience. He is the proud CEO of AI Parentology, which he's going to unpack with that, but also brings a level of expertise from the K-12 vertical as well, being in positions that focus on AI innovation on a systems and a county level. He'll be able to bring that experiences, all of his educational experiences, to this podcast. But Kunal, man, that look, I'll tell you, it is an absolute honor, not only just to call you a brother, to call you a good friend of mine, but just to have you on VFE to share some knowledge and expertise. What's going on in the sunny state of California?
Man, I feel like I should retire now after that introduction. Like that was, I've done my job. I can move on now. When Dr. Connor introduces you like that, you can go ahead and step off the stage. You've done your work. I'm doing well.
Kunal, this will be the quickest episode of VFE. Just the introduction and that's it.
We're moving on. We're done. No, this is, you know, I'm going to tell you this. I was laid out in bed the whole day yesterday, not feeling well. And I was sort of like worried that I wouldn't be my best self coming in to this podcast episode this morning. But I'm going to tell you, I woke up and I realized that my body was telling me something yesterday, and my body was telling me that I need to slow down for a second. And I'm going to use this moment here with you to be able to really sort of think big picture, think granular, but also let's really consider like the larger and more systemic ramifications of what we're talking about here. And of course, there's the nitty gritty of getting everything done every day, of what's this strategy and what is it that we need to do on the ground on the day to day. But also, you know, I'm also going to call you former Superintendent Connor. This is big picture stuff, and this is fundamental, foundational stuff in the work that you're doing. And my hope is that the work that I'm doing feeds into that. So, you know, thank you for that introduction. I'm not sure how to follow that up, but I'm going to do my best.
To my audience, the last time Kunal and I saw each other, we were at ASU GSV in San Diego. And Kunal, I'll never forget, we were walking from the convention center back to the main hotel. And the conversation that we had on how we can be able to improve the education model in totality, that was when I said, I got to get you on my podcast, because right there, it was hot that day. I remember, because it was cold back home in New York and coming to California, San Diego. And I was profusely sweating as I was walking. But the intent, I was so focused on you. I was like, man, I need to go back, take a shower. I didn't even know I was sweating like that. And literally to my audience, it was literally like a 7 or 8 minute walk up the street. But the nuggets that I got from Kunal just from that 8 minute walk, wow. Now that we have 60 minutes to be able to unpack this in totality for my audience. Again, this was purely selfish, getting you on VFV so they can be able to hear that reciprocal conversation that we had and really go deep now in some of those threads from April at the ASU GSV Summit. But the first question, Kunal, I always like to use this question as a fun question. So my audience to be able to get to know you, you are, and this is factual and statistically grounded, you are a national voice with AI. To me and my lens, subjectively and objectively to many others, you are a regarded thought leader in this space when it comes to this topic in education. But for those, whether it be domestically here in the United States or internationally, who tune in to Voices for Excellence that do not know who Kunal is, what song unpacks your leadership signature and impact in the ecosystem?
Well, I hope this isn't too unserious, but it is serious. Lupe Fiasco, Go Go Gadget Flow is what I, when I need to get started, I put that on and I feel like flow, go, go. And it's just, it has a step to it that tells me to move. And so when I saw that question, you sent that question to me ahead of time, I was like, do I say this out loud or do I make up something more inspirational? But no, I'm just going to tell you from the heart. I put Lupe on and that's where I go.
I'll tell you, Lupe Fiasco. Wow. I love Lupe, right? I love his album. That is a classic. I consider kind of like a Lupe with like the Roots, you know, that family, right? That's in there. But Lupe, yes, absolutely. But the song you talk about specifically, Go Go Gadget Flow, when I think about that, in the AC stage of education, I always like to say there's that level of strategic urgency, right? We're working in this urgent manner where we have to have this go-go type of gadget flow. But then also at the same time with the strategic urgency, there's that level of strategic intent as we're flowing. So we're accelerating, moving fast because AI is revitalizing and revolutionizing education as we speak. And it's so fast paced and this flow that it's just natural that when we think about the AC stage of education after COVID-19, we do need to have that strategic urgency and intent with this go-go gadget flow with that. But we are on the move. And Kunal, to be honest with you, you know, I still hear, and this is probably going to curl your skin when you hear this, but I still hear we're not going to adopt AI. We're not going to exponentially expand with this level of attentionality with technology and various machine learning platforms. Moreover, this confluence of AI is going to end at a certain point in the future when people don't realize that this is going to be the mainstay in education and we can't keep on kicking the can down the road. Go, 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 gadget flow. Such a good song. And Lupe. I didn't know you were going to bring out Lupe now. That was the first on VFB. That is on VFB, my brother. But here's the thing. I want to keep on touting your work because I'm just absolutely fascinated by your work and also a fan of it as well, Kunal. Keep doing that. Keep impacting and influence. But you are on the forefront of AI innovation in this ecosphere. So with regards to your expertise, right, I want to part and parcel this isolated in a linear context. With regards to your expertise with micro schools, first of all, what is this model for my audience? And how do you see it being leveraged broadly by 2030? And Kunal, the rationale, I say 2030, 2035, is that's really when my theory of action takes into effect, where the 22nd century education model has to be lamented to support Generation Alpha and Generation Beta, right? So that's the first question about these micro schools. The second part is, from a disruptive innovation lens, how will AI frame the model of micro schools in this AC stage of education?
this is like, I mean, I appreciate this conversation. Like, we're going into the real meat of the matter here. We're not going to talk fluff here. And I appreciate that. I think let me step back and let's just sort of unpack microschools in general, right? I think the idea of microschools in general has been around for a long time. And we tended to call them, we grouped them with homeschooling up until I think more recently. And homeschooling meaning here in the US specifically, that parents take on the responsibility of, you know, doing what the student would have been completing in a public school, but they do it at home. And then they check in with their resident public school district with evidence that their student has made the progress or completed whatever they're going to complete. Sometimes the school itself will provide materials to the parent and the home, and then the parent will shepherd that learning. And so that used to be homeschooling, and then you'd start. And then with COVID, what you started to see was these pods forming, these learning pods, right? Which, you know, we still sort of thought of them as homeschool learning pods, but really we're talking about micro schools now, where we have a community-built system or community-built space, right? It could have been someone's home. It could have been like probably someone's home because it was COVID. We probably weren't going into public buildings at the time. But it'd be in someone's home. Now it might be at a community center. It might be at a faith-based organization, something like that. But these little pods of parents, little pods of students would go through whatever curriculum they needed to go through. But then also, I think, experience something that students in a larger setting were missing, which was the intimacy of being in that small community. And we have cliques forming in large schools anyway, which sort of mimic those pods, right, in a way. But those cliques often form in almost like antagonistically, right, to the larger group sometimes. And you and I both as with the skin color we walk around with, we know that often we had to find cliques that were in opposition to sort of the main narrative that's going on out there. And sometimes it was in defense of. And so I noticed during COVID, there were a lot of parents who started to really, for the first time, I think, ask the question of, is school the best place for my kid to spend most of their day? Now, this question wasn't being asked in a legitimate sense. I think mainstream-wise, it wasn't being asked yet because we were on autopilot. And it's hard to sort of go back to 2019 because the world has changed so much. But in 2019, we weren't thinking about, and I know because I was, and nobody was listening and nobody cared about what I was saying. And everybody thought I was crazy and everybody thought I was anti-public schools, which I was not. And I never have been. But then at COVID, finally, I started to see the first sort of inkling of parents being like, hold on a minute. Like, I'm seeing what's happening. They're sitting on a computer and they're learning. They're not really learning. They're just going through these exercises. And then is this what you do when you're at school? Yeah, this is what we do when we're at school too. You're just kind of going in this sequential order and doing things that, like, basically that we were doing when we were kids in school as well. And so right on the heels of that comes the public release of generative AI. So we've got these two monumental things that happened back to back. I have a theory of what would have happened had the order been reversed, which I'll get to in a second. But the order of COVID and then generative AI making its public release. Parents are in this stage. And first of all, let me say, there was a lot of Black and brown parents specifically who were asking this question of, do I need to send my kid to this place where they're not made to feel good about themselves every day, where they have to essentially, in a way, defend their existence every day? Do I need to send my kids to that school? Of course, in most cases, those parents, not in most cases, but in many cases, those parents are also potentially the least resource to go out and go find some private alternative or find, you know, whatever it is, some logistical alternative. And so I have no choice, but I'm going to send my kid to this school. But even before COVID, I was noticing in a charter school that I was partnered with, a lot of parents some more wealthy parents saying, you know what? I don't think my kid needs to finish senior year. I don't think my kid needs to go to college because they're not learning anything. They're just going to go into this internship with this person I know, and then they're going to go from there. They'll do their high school stuff, you know, online, and they'll get it done. And these were privileged parents, right, that were doing that, but they were privileged. They had the chance to do that. But anyway, getting back to this, what I see as an evolution. Now with AI, not only do a lot of parents see an opportunity for their kids to be a little bit more independent in their learning and be independently collaborative in their learning. I know that sounds contradictory, but I mean that kids have an opportunity to determine their own collaborative space and build their learning and their what they see as their efficacy in the world in their own supportive, collaborative space with AI. And micro schools were really hard to do in the past. You had to create all your materials on your own. You had to grade all your materials on your own. You had to jump through all these hoops around whatever it is the district was looking for. It was hard work. It's not such hard work now with AI. You have a partner now. This AI partner can help you deal with some of this more bureaucratic stuff that frankly does not help learning, right? It's just compliance stuff that you have to do because bureaucracies thrive on compliance. But learning is not a monastic bureaucratic space. Learning is a space of change, of efficacy, of value to yourself and to your community. I don't need to fill out paperwork to do that. No, we've never filled out paperwork to do that. And so in this moment right now, in this post-COVID, this AC world that you're talking about, micro schools right now have an opportunity to be sort of the laboratories of a new model of self-efficacy. And that's what I see education as, is a exercise in providing our young folks an unequivocal look into the self-efficacy they have. And if the world was a great place to live in right now and everything was sustainable and people were joyful, then I'd say, you know, they don't need to have any efficacy in the world. We can just learn for the sake of learning. But this world needs all the help that we can get. And kids have beautiful, brilliant ideas, and they have not been soured by the world the way that many of us adults have. And they can solve this world. I often say the only people who can see a new world are the ones that have no stake in the current one. And no matter how much I want to change this world, I've found some success. I'm on this podcast right now, right? And so I might still say, oh yeah, you know, let's change that. But you know, this part isn't so bad, but that's not how we want to brainstorm. I want kids to brainstorm. I want you to have no connection to the world we have right now. Imagine a good one. And now with the help of AI, we might actually be able to get there, but we're not going to get there if we continue to build this compliance-based mass model, age stratified, you know, standards. Like, standards are good, but not when they're tyrannical, because we're at a point where they're almost tyrannical at this point.
Thank you for that, because when I think about this now with this whole micro school evolution, the model, we really haven't talked about disruptive and radical model designs in the context of teaching and learning, specifically learning, where we're shifting the autonomy to the students. We're still, even with, I always like to say, in the DC stage of education during COVID-19, we truly had to challenge the status quo of education. And when we think about what evolved during that specific time frame, generative AI, as you talked about, right? The continuous questioning and the continuous unpacking of the standardized learning model and asking those very hard essential questions to challenge the status quo model that you and I and pretty much every other educator has been educated, sequential activities with delineated cut scores. And if you don't meet the specific cut scores, you are categorized or even classified into a specific quadrant, where sometimes that's where we know biases, we know stereotypes are elicited from that. But this whole micro school model, where it shifts the autonomy to the students, where we're looking at this elevated self-efficacy of a student's. And like you said, I like the dichotomy between independency and being collaborative. I think we have to explore these models. I mean, Kunal, if you think about it, people used to think we were crazy when we were talking about AI in 17 and 18 and having the same level of conversations that we're having in 2025. So when people say you were crazy talking about the micro schools, they also thought we were crazy when we were talking about AI back in 17 and 18 with that. So now, Kunal, I just want you to expand on this shortly before we get into your critical work. Where do you see micro schools in the next 5 years? And do you see parents shifting these choices to attend micro schools as opposed to some of the traditional brick and mortar programs, i.e. school that we know of?
I mean, I think the shift is in some ways going to be inevitable. The question is, do districts want to be a part of that or not? I've met multiple superintendents now who have said, I've talked to my board and I've told my board, if we don't build micro schools within our district, we're not going to have a district. And multiple superintendents have said that to me. And so they know, and that may not be all superintendents, but the fact that you know this well, in order to get to be a superintendent, you have to have spent a lot of time in public education and you have to have a deep, deep belief in what you're building, right? And when someone at that level with that much, and especially one superintendent who has spent his entire career in the same district, like he started as a teacher in that district, and then now is a superintendent, has an incredible story. And he himself said, look, this district is done if we don't have micro schools as part of our offerings as a district. And so I think districts actually have an incredible opportunity because they have an infrastructure that sort of isolated pods would not have. But you can't take away the autonomy of the micro schools if you start to, you know, quote, districtize or you use the district model to build. We had the small school movement, but the small school movement didn't exist when generative AI was public. It was hard to do. We can learn from failures from the past, but we can't dismiss opportunities that we have because we say, hey, we tried this before. No, we didn't try it before in the age of generative AI or in an AC world, right? We didn't try it. We have no idea. And so sure, small, you know, breaking up big schools into smaller things, that didn't work in a lot of places. Building small charter schools, that didn't work in a lot of places. It did work in a lot of places. I lived in Boston for a while where there are an incredible array of small charter schools. And so that model can work in a pre-AI world, but certainly in an AI world, if we figure this out, we can have it work beautifully, potentially. But we as adults, you and me, teachers, leaders, superintendents, boards, we have to believe in this model. Kids can't build this on their own. Kids are the clients and the customers of education, yet they are the most powerless. And so if we don't listen to them like they are the most powerful people in the room, then we're not going to get this right. And so that's what we have to do. We have to listen to them as if they're the most powerful people in the room. And what are they saying? This is what I talk about with followership. And I talk about this a lot. There are bajillion things on leadership. We don't talk about followership. And the last book I found on followership was like in 1988 or something. But followership to me, it sort of mimics, not mimic necessarily, but there's a lot of elements of servant leadership, I think, that are embedded in followership. But followership to me is, I'm going to see what the students are saying. And I'm not going to just get out of the way and let them do it. No, I'm going to use what expertise I have, what connections I have, what networks I have. And I'm going to try to, if I need to break down some barriers, I will. If I need to offer some support here, I will. If I need to collect some people to help you realize something or help you, you know, whatever it is, I will do that. But I'm going to lean into followership. I cannot lead you to your future. That's absurd. So I am going to lead the adults around me to try to understand that you all are the folks we need to listen to. It's your world. And we've done enough to make it hard for them. Let's be honest, our generation, like, so I'm just like, let's get out of the way a little bit, man.
And let them lead. And Kunal, I'll tell you this, if I was sitting in the seat right now, I would be thinking about designing a micro school's vertical pathway K-12 within my learning organization, where students will be able to opt into it at that specific whatever grade level. With that is just me just thinking about this. I just hearing you speak, I just loved how you separated the functions or the functionalities, because one of the misnomers is that micro schools is this enhanced model implementation of the small school movement, which there's some, I like to say, difference of functionalities from micro schools versus the small school movement. Yeah. Thank you for clearing that. But Kunal, man,
And I'll add in real quick, I think to really nail in the distinction, the small school movement was determined by districts, by boards, top down. Micro schools is bottom up. It's determined by students, by parents, bottom up.
Unbelievable. And I'm sure my audience is going to reach out to you with regards to that, clearly the distinction and what is micro schools with that. But Kunal, man, I'll tell you this, and I've been around, been at different ends of the country, different ends of the world, and I have not met an AI parentologist. Okay, I'm just letting you know. I have not met an AI parentologist in education. That's why I consider you one of the extreme brilliant innovators in the ecosystem. So it is, first of all, it's cutting edge, right? Because you're going to have to unpack that for my audience, what you're doing with regards to innovation and AI and parents. So first, my first question is, define and unpack what an AI parentologist is so necessary. I have many conversations with you about this, know your work exclusively, but I want to be able to get the word out there about what you're doing specifically in the context of this AI parentologist. But I seen your work in the UAE, or you having some work that's being rooted in the GCC area, which is phenomenal that this work is getting to be recognized internationally. But with this 22nd century focus in the AC stage of education, how does your AI Parentology Institute, right, that has already been launched in the Middle East, how does that work deepen the scope of supports with Generation Alpha, Generation Beta, our most important customers in the ecosystem?
Yeah. I mean, this is the heart of what I do. This is the stuff that I've been a teacher and an educator my whole career. And I'm a more recent parent, but I didn't realize that I was a parent my whole life. I just didn't have kids yet. And so this is something that's been a joy to me to realize. And so, you know, this started, I'll sort of tell you the story of how it started. I'll try not to be too long-winded, but it started when I had been laid off during the COVID layoffs. And I also had had my first child at that time, right before COVID started. And so as I got laid off, I said, you know what? This is actually a great opportunity. I got a decent severance. And then we had enhanced unemployment during COVID. And then we were okay. So I was like, I get to be a stay-at-home dad. I want to be a stay-at-home dad. I've been wanting to do this. I was like, let me do this for a year. Let me do it for a year and a half. It ended up being 3 years, longer than I thought, but a great 3 years. But during that time, ChatGPT became public. And you know, at the time, I was shocked because I'd been following AI and I'd been following generative AI. And I definitely thought we were still like 10, 20 years from something like this going public. And not only did it go public, but it was somewhat decent. It wasn't trash. And so then at some point, you know, I was looking at it, cool, whatever. And then there was a moment where my little boy, he's 2 at the time, he got a cut on his hand. And so he put a bandaid on, and his cousin went and put a bandaid on his hand as well, on her hand as well. And so he asked me, why is she wearing a bandaid? She doesn't have a cut. I have a cut. And so then I, in my infinite wisdom, decided I'm going to try to explain solidarity to a 2-year-old. And so I'm sitting here being like, so, you know, fumbling around trying to help him understand solidarity. And so then I go, I'm like, you know what? There's this ChatGPT thing. Let me go ask. And so I'm like, how do I explain solidarity to a 2-year-old? And the answer it gave me was so good. It was so good. I was like, wait, what? And so then I went in and started asking a few other questions. I was like, hey, this is his favorite TV show. Can you make parallels with Shakespearean characters? And it did. And, you know, of the five, two of them were made up, but three of them were real. And I was like, what is happening right now? Because I was like, at that point, we were still in the stage of, there has to be a paper written about this somewhere. Something has to exist. Otherwise, it can't figure that knowledge out. Now we've gotten more accustomed to it making stuff up. But at the time, you know, we still didn't even understand this thing. And so I was just like, in that moment, I was like, two things happened. First, education is never going to be the same. I had been away from public education for 10 years at that point. I'd been Silicon Valley companies, startups in the Bay Area. And I was like, I need to get back into public education because this is going to change everything. And the second thing I thought was, this is going to make me an insanely awesome parent. I need to just figure out how to do it in the right way and not do it in a way. And so the solidarity thing, A, it taught me that. But the second thing I did was I was like, oh, it can also make images. Let me try to make it. And it made this image of these two kids kind of looking at each other and kindly looking at each other. And I was like, there's solidarity again. And both of these examples are in what then led me to write my first book called The AI Parent. And it was the first one, March 2023. It was a thin little volume. There wasn't much in it, but it was really sharing how I use AI almost every day, less so these days, but at the time, almost every day with my child. It was that kind of stuff, learning solidarity, but also he was asking me about my childhood when I was a kid and I was growing up in India. And I don't have images. I don't have pictures. I don't have a whole lot of context, like visual context for him to look at. So I go online, YouTube, and everything looks different, right? Like it's, you know, of course, things in the 90s look different from today. But certainly if you're talking about a developing country, things look nothing like they did in the 90s, right? Here in America, maybe you can see some similarities. But in a developing country, nothing looks like anything did in the 90s today. And so I went in and I started asking, hey, pretend it's 1993 and you're in Calcutta. And the images it came up with were so good. I mean, they weren't super accurate, but they gave me the feelings. And so I shared that with my son. And I was like, hey, look, this is what it felt like to ride a train with my uncle and eat food in Calcutta. And he could sort of feel me being there. And so that led to my first book, The AI Parent. It made it to the New York Times bestseller. Oh, wait, sorry. I misread that. The New York Times worst selling list. I definitely thought people would be so into it. And it made nobody even notice because who was thinking about AI and parenting? Like that was not a thing. And I realize that now. But I went in, I started my work at Orange County Department of Ed. And then I wrote my second one last year, second edition. Much, much better response, much more dense volume, talking about music that I make with my son, art that we make together, dream journals that we do. So, and I'll give you a few examples of what it means to be an AI parentologist is I have developed a 2-year window into my son's dreams, how his dreams have evolved, because we have been doing AI image generation of his dreams for 2 whole years now. We started when he had a dream and he was describing it. And I was like, should we do this? Should we make an AI image of it? And he was like, you know, sure, whatever. And so we do. And sometimes it's accurate, sometimes it's not. But I've noticed, for example, his dreams, and this is so, I mean, to me, this is such an incredible insight to have of your child. His dreams 2 years ago were always about other things, right? It was about monster trucks or dinosaurs or, you know, whales or whatever, spiders. And now he himself is in all of the dreams. Like he is like running through a field. And the other day we did an image generation with him running through the field in one of his dreams. And he discovered how to iterate with AI. I did not teach him this, by the way. This is something he just discovered on his own. And what did he do? He was like,
here, I'm going to just, and now, you know, he can just talk to ChatGPT, right? Before he had to tell me and I had to type it in. Now he can just talk. So he talks, it creates an image, and he looks at it and he's like, nah, that's not right. So he goes to his drawing corner, uses a pen and paper, draws a little pencil diagram, brings it back. It says, take a picture of that. I took a picture of it. And then he describes that picture to ChatGPT. And then a new image pops up. And now he's like, yep, that looks a lot closer to my dream. He just figured that out on his own as a four-year-old. And so that, you know, we were walking across the street the other day. I shared the story a little bit because I think it's just the most incredible. We were walking across the street the other day and he says, Bobby, the world is changing so fast. I'm like, what are you talking about, you little five-year-old? What do you mean the world changes so fast? And I was like, but you know, the world has changed a lot in five years. So he's not wrong. But then I was like, so what do you mean by that? And he was like, well, Bobby, AI is getting so strong. And I was like, damn, kid, like what? Like, where is this coming? Like, okay, so then I was like, yes, you're right. But what do you mean by that? And he was like, well, the images have gotten so much better than they used to be. And I was like, see, so he, through the lens that he can understand, is visualizing our world changing. And to me, as an AI parentologist, and by the way, well, let me complete that sentence and then I'll say, by the way, as an AI parentologist, that is my role. My role is to help shepherd my little boy to a space where he can understand that the ground underneath him is moving and shifting. And for that to not be frightening, to not be scary, and to know that he's got me, he's got his mom, he's got his sister, he's got his grandparents, he's got his friends, that we are all constant. This whole other thing, we don't know what's happening. And we're going to have to try to keep up, or we're going to have to try to do whatever. We are constant. I am constant. My humanity here does not move. As an AI parentologist, and I'll say that term, by the way, was given to me. Someone else you absolutely need to have on your pod, Wakani Hoffman, who is, you may know her from her LinkedIn work, but she is a leader in indigenous AI. She's originally from Kenya, currently lives in the Netherlands, and she is the lead of the Inclusive AI Lab at Utrecht University in the Netherlands. And she travels the globe talking about basically the indigenous incorporation of AI, or AI incorporation in indigenous thought, and how we can rethink AI from an efficiency perspective and rather think of it from a more indigenous community perspective. An incredible human being. But she's the one, I had her on as a guest on a webinar, and she actually was like, you're an AI parentologist. And I was like, I'm using that. And that's just going to be what I do. And now I have a website. Now I'm doing the work. And I'll say, just a side little vertical that I have is the corporate lens to this. If you go to the website, you'll see that I'm offering to companies who want to be a part of this. I'm offering to companies, hey, do you know that 3 out of 4 of employees who are parents are losing sleep over AI for their kids? 75% of parents are losing sleep because they're worried about their kids' futures in this AI world. And is your employee wellness program addressing the most immediate fear that your parent employees have? Because if you're not, then you're just putting paint on this really, really rattly building. But otherwise, hey, I can, you can if you want, but I have a program too. Bring me in for a day. I have a 2-day workshop too. Bring me in for 2 days. Have your parent employees and others who are not parents who also want to understand this moment from that lens, bring them in and let's talk. Let's talk this out. Let's build something together. Let's uplift the work that the parents are doing and the pain and confusion and uncertainty that they're all feeling, because that is a productivity linchpin, is that your employees feel like you as an organization care about the things that they care about, not just, you know, put painting on, but actually care about the things you care about. So that's also, now I've sort of evolved my work there's the personal side. I had a Lighthouse Homes event 2 weeks ago where I had my first Lighthouse Homes event. It's so awesome that I got to have that. But we had 15 parents from around the community come together, and we ate. I cooked for everyone. I cooked delicious Indian food, I must say. We all sat around and we talked about AI. We talked about our kids. We talked about what this might mean for our future. And we tried to start making a plan about how we were going to stay connected and create an intentional community within ourselves. So I'm doing that on a personal community level. And then my hope is I can get some folks at a corporate level who see the value in having this conversation and having these sort of sessions.
And a great, great response with that, because I think that now this can't just be limited to education. I think that it has to be scaled, and it has to have more of a cataclysmic impact on the context of being from this positive notion, of course, because I just love the fact of how this model that you constructed was built through the eyes of your son, right? And that's where I think that now more education leaders, more, I like to say, education architects, with this notion of understanding that we have to be able to design with our most important customers' lens as the primary factor for that, and using Generation Alpha, Generation Beta to be able to construct, I think, some of the most important next steps, because this is going to impact the 22nd century. And believe it or not, and I tell people this, and I'm glad that, you know, people aren't looking at me as if I was crazy, but the focus is that now we have to be able to have this shift to the 22nd century, even though it's 75 years away. But Kunal, I want to go to a topic that's very near to your heart, and I want you to focus this question for our AI developers. Right. And I want you to unpack exhibit your expertise, but I want you to unpack this from this context of promulgating impact. We know, you and I know, a lot of people know, this algorithmic bias that is a universal concern with the development of artificial intelligence. Now, when I speak about this specifically, these concerns from many of our cadres that we talk to at the executive level, cabinet level within our school districts, they do exist when we talk about this, about what are some of your broad concerns with AI. One of the data models that I was taking a look at suggests by 2030 that 60% of our student enrollment demographics will be Black, Brown, or two or more races, right? So where diversity within our classrooms, diversity within our learning organizations are going to continue to grow. But when we think about these economic shifts, right, one of the contributing factors is because of who we just welcomed in on January 1st, Generation Beta, one of the most diverse generations of mankind that supersedes Generation Alpha, because at the time, Generation Alpha was one of the most diverse generations of mankind. But first, I want you, Kunal, because you can speak this technical language to them, to our software engineers, to our junior engineers, to our analysts or UX designers, what are the key considerations, Kunal, that we have to, or they have to take in consideration in the context of design? What are those non-negotiables to eliminate biases within our models that we're designing? And second, how can we ensure that these AI models are trained on diverse data sets that accurately represent the cultural backgrounds and perspectives of Generation Alpha and Generation Beta? Because we know, Kunal, we sit in the back in all these conversations, the degree of accuracy within the models. We're continuing to test and train these models until we hit an F1, F2 accuracy level. But we're not taking into consideration the diverse data sets. We're not taking into consideration that some of the rigidity with the outputs of these models is because we're factoring student demographics and groups that haven't historically been integrated from this input throughput perspective of the design of AI models. But what would you say to them, Kunal?
I almost feel like this is an infinite question, because I don't think we're ever going to get to a resolution per se. I think it's going to reach an asymptote where we slowly get closer and closer, but we got to keep working. and we got to keep working, and we're going to always keep getting closer. But we're never, I don't think we're ever going to solve. So let me start by saying, I don't even use the term AI bias. I use the term embedded prejudice, because I think sometimes when we use the term AI bias or algorithmic bias, we sort of unload the bias to the machine rather than appreciating that it is just us. It has nothing to do with the machine. The machine is just doing math based on what we fed it. And so that step one is to recognize where it comes from. It's not coming from AI. AI didn't make any of this stuff up. AI didn't exist, right? And so that's step one. Step two is, I think for me, and I say step two, this isn't, I don't mean this to be sequential. Step two might be sideways to step one. I don't know. But I think another step here is to appreciate that these language models, no matter how much we try to diversify their training data, I just did a little exercise with one of the deep research models on this, because I was thinking, I was like, you know, these training data models, they're only trained on written things, on words that have been written down. 99% of human history did not have written language. And up to 99% of what we do isn't written down. We just talk, right? And so we're only capturing 1% of the human experience. Even if we capture 100% of everything that's ever been written down in the history of humankind, we're still probably only capturing 1% of what we are. And so there's no way that these models are going to represent us as humans in the way that we would hope it would, in a complete way. They just can't. And so I think that, to me, is an understanding of the limitations of what these models are. They're just models, and they're just, I always use the word, these are reflections, right? These are just reflections of what we put into it. My view of generative AI is, I sort of came up with this analogy maybe 2 months ago, but it's this reflective galaxy of words, right? I put words out in the form of a prompt, and then those words go out into this AI galaxy, swirl around in its galactic soup of words that it has. And then based on what my words were, in the words that it runs into in its swirl of galaxies, it spits out a new set of words. And those words are now what I see as my reflection through this AI model of what it is I'm trying to accomplish, what things I'm trying to do, what I'm trying to understand. So it's this reflection of me. Now, if I don't understand that reflection is going through this galaxy of words, that is not a galaxy of words of human experience, but rather a galaxy of words solely of written and digitized human knowledge, then I'm not understanding the value of what this process is. And what is written and what is digitized, that, to me, is the step where we start to ask. That's where we ask questions of whose voices are being written down, whose voices are actually being codified, whose voices are we going to be able to embed for future generations. And then I'll leave a step back, another step, and this might make you feel a little bit weird too. But I did this provocation the other day in one of my sessions where I said, you know, Moana, she's from an indigenous Polynesian culture. They didn't have a written language. Every single solitary thing that they learned, did, understood, none of that's in any AI model. Yes, it can't be. It wasn't written down. These are large language models. They only work on what's written. And so I can complain that the indigenous Polynesian lens is missing. But what am I complaining about? Like, it's something that's non-existent. It doesn't exist. And that, the step where it doesn't exist, that's the step that we need to reflect on. That's the step where we say, hey, okay, the Portuguese colonizers came in and they removed all indigenous things. So now let me go back there. And now let me go study that. And let me go think about what that means for today, right? This is, to me, an incredibly complex view. And AI, to me, that is one of the biggest powers that AI has given us is it's given us this reflective lens where we don't get to bullshit ourselves anymore. Pardon my language, but we don't get to mess with ourselves anymore because this statistical algorithmic robot is sending this stuff back to me. How am I going to say that you've got some sort of like agenda? You don't have an agenda, but you don't care. You're just an algorithmic reflective robot. And because of that, I am forced to do my own, our own, as a world, gaps, silences, right? This is my partner, Wes Kreisel, who you know well. He talks about the gaps and silences all the time. And that's what we are forced to look at. And so when we're talking from a technical perspective, I think the most important technical perspective is actually technical on our end, is to understand the limitations that, frankly, these model builders are working with. They don't actually have a whole lot to work with. They only have at most 1% of anything useful that we've ever done at their hands to even feed the models, let alone then work from there. And so that comes on us to sophisticate ourselves. I don't know if that's a word, but I'll use it. To sophisticate ourselves, to make sure that we understand that we are using this thing gives us really cool information and it sounds really interesting sometimes. And I use it in that way all the time. But also, it's coming from a knowledge base that is fractional to who we are. And it's an infant. It's barely been out in the world. I can't expect AI to be all, you know, be a sage at 2 years old, at 3 years old. It's a little baby right now. So that would be, I hope that's not a sidestepping of your question, but that's sort of my feelings on it.
This is good because I like the reclassification of algorithmic biases to embedded prejudices. And I think we need to be able to expand on that and unpack that with more depth and breadth, because the example that you provided with regards to these trained models is compelling, but it has enhanced us to have this reflective lens, right? And absolutely. Because one thing that you talked about and highlighted is that this level of complexities that we need to continue to investigate and interrogate, and that you stated it perfectly, that we are still in the infancy stages of this level of implementation. And you're so right about this algorithmic bot is not, you know, put in this strategic intent with regards to this embedded prejudice. But again, you know, we have to continue to look at some of these trained models and some of these data sets that, as you stated, you know, they're fractional. And to my audience, this is one of the answers. We use this as an asynchronous tool for professional learning, self-directed learning, i.e. heterodagogy. And this last statement or answer that you provided, there could be roughly about 6 or 7 different strategies that can be unpacked in high-level discussions and conversations, because this conversation around bias or embedded prejudice within these specific models, large language models, outputs from these generative tools is something that I'm seeing a lot of educators get frustrated with, right? And there could be, then the frustration is coming again. And as you're saying, they're pulling, extracting data from multiple areas that are being trained. And these hallucinations that come up on the specific outputs with some of these tools is frustrating educators. And they're asking me, how do we eliminate bias? And I'm like, that is a daunting task. That is a large scale, daunting task that is going to take a multitude of years. So that's like asking, how do we eliminate biases within instruction? How do we leverage culturally responsive practices? And that was a part of my dissertation. And that was 15 years ago. We're still having the same discussion. I'm inferring that we're probably going to have the same discussions when we talk about prejudice and embedded prejudices and biases within algorithmic models. But Kunal, last question, good brother, last question. Now, I try not to contain individuals to only 3 words when they come on VFE, but I want you to be able to take this question as it is. And I'm sure you're going to break the rules with this because you're a disruptive innovator, just like myself. But good brother, what three words, right? Limiting you to you and I, the three words that what three words do you, I don't even want to get into it, but what three words do you want our audience to leave with regarding innovation and AI in the AC stage of education?
The one word that I constantly think about is resilience. And I think what, and this is coming from sort of the tail end of what you just said right before this, where teachers are asking you, how do we eliminate the bias? How do we eliminate the bias? Well, if we eliminated the bias, then we would also likely have, we could then eliminate our critical thinking too, because there's no bias anymore. And so now we don't have to think critically because there's nothing bad out there. So in a way, the biases are keeping us, they're keeping our antenna up, right? Making sure that we're aware of what we're looking at, and it's more real that way, right? And so to me, that's resilience. It is knowing that you might see something that's going to make you feel like hell, or you might see something or read something that demonizes somebody else, or something, you know, whatever it is, right? But then finding that resilience within you to be able to hang on, and also resilience in this moment. It is so uncertain. We are not built for this level of rapid pace and uncertainty. And so leaning into resilience, that's step one. Don't run from it. Lean into resilience. Two, I don't know if this is a single word or not, but open-minded. We are not in a world that resembles our world even 5 years ago. And listen to the words of my little five-year-old boy when he said, "Bobby, the world is changing so fast." If a five-year-old can see what is happening, this is like that. This is like that Reddit thing. Explain it like I'm a five-year-old. Well, my five-year-old explained it to us. If my five-year-old can explain to us that this world is moving so fast, then let's all pause for a minute. Take stock of that. It doesn't mean stop. It doesn't mean whatever, but take stock. And if you feel uncertain, if you're feeling unsteady, if you're feeling queasy, that's because that's what's happening. And so be open-minded to A, the challenges and how much is shifting, but also be open-minded what the potential positives and the potential upsides, what's possible. That's it. And the last one, this is a word I think we all just always have to have, and that's joy. Joy, 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 joy. This is not a time to overanalyze things because things are too uncertain. This is not a time to get mired in fear and angst and all of that. There's a little bit of grieving that we need to do because there is a world that we're losing. And I don't think there's any way around that. But there's a world that we're gaining that we don't know. And we get to make that world how we want to make it. And that, if we do it with joy, then our kids, our generation alpha, our generation beta, and us as the stewards of that world, we all get to be joyful. So lean into joy. Don't be so serious all the time, folks. Lean into joy.
Absolutely. Resilience, open-minded, and joy. Kunal Dalla, thank you. The first AI parentologist in the world.
Your service, sir.
Listen, and when we speak of at your service, please, if my audience want to come out to contact you, to have you in their district or corporation, what's the best way to get in touch with you?
My email, Kunal, K-U-N-A-L at AIParentology.com. And just send me an email. Get me connected. Go to my site, AIParentology.com. You can fill out a contact form there as well. You can see a little bit of what I'm offering and what my hopes are. You can see a little bit about the UAE workshop that we're doing in a couple of weeks. But yeah, go to AIParentology.com or email me directly at Kunal at AIParentology.com. That's it.
Kunal, it was such an honor to have you on VFE. Appreciate you. Listen, I'm coming out to the left coast, coming to see you. It's like I said, I've been busy, as you know, with this AEG systems and this 22nd century model and my platform and AI and all that. But I got to break bread with you, brother. And listen, make sure we got it a weekly basis, just because iron sharpens iron. And trust me, you know, I learned so much from you. So from the bottom of my heart, brother, thank you. Thank you for coming on BFE.
It has been my joy and my pleasure. Can't wait to talk again soon.
Absolutely. And on that note, onward and upward, everybody. Have a great evening.